Mystical Hope, Trusting in the Mercy of God by Cynthia Bourgeau. Chapter 2, Living in the Mercy. For as the heavens reach beyond earth and time, we swim in mercy as in an endless sea. Psalm 103. Before we can really begin to work with the idea of hope dwelling within rather than coming from without, we need to have some picture of where and how it could dwell in us. What inside us could embody it? Obviously, there is a paradox here, an eye of the needle to thread. We ourselves are not the source of that hope. We do not manufacture it. But the source dwells deep within us and flows to us with an unstinting abundance. So much so that in fact it might be more accurate to say we dwell within it. The story comes to mind of the little fish swimming up to its mother, all in a panic. "Mama, mama, what's water? I gotta find water or I'll die." We live immersed in this water, and the reason we miss it is not that it is so far away, but paradoxically so close, more intimate to us than our being itself. The term I will use to describe this embodying fullness is the mercy. It is the water in which we swim. Mercy is the length and breadth and height and depth of what we know of God and the light by which we know it. You might even think of it as the being of God, insofar as we can possibly penetrate into it in this life, so that it is impossible to encounter God apart from the dimension of mercy. The choice of term may seem a bit odd. Today, mercy, along with so many of the other classic words in our spiritual tradition, has developed a negative connotation. It seems to suggest power and condescension, a transaction between two vastly unequal parties. A friend of mine, in fact, was told by her spiritual director that she should not pray the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. The mainstay of Eastern Orthodox contemplative spirituality, because it reinforces medieval stereotypes of paternalism and powerlessness. Modern people, this spiritual director felt, need to be told that they are worthy and that they can stand on their own two feet before God. But the word mercy comes profoundly attested to in our Judeo-Christian spiritual heritage. Aside from the fact that the Jesus prayer, hallowed by two millennia of Christian practice, has been consistently singled out by the spiritual masters of our path as the most powerful prayer a Christian can pray, we simply cannot get away from the mercy without getting away from the Bible as well. The word confronts us at every turn as a living reality of our faith. It is all over the Old Testament, especially in the prophets and in the Psalms. For a start, consider the following. "For I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Hosea 6:6. "What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." Micah 6:8. "He redeems your life from the grave and crowns you with mercy and loving kindness." Psalm 103:4. "He remembers his mercy and faithfulness to the house of Israel." Psalm 98:4. "His mercy is everlasting." Psalm 100:4. "His mercy endures forever." Psalms 107:1 and 136:1. And while the frequency of references to mercy may decline somewhat in the New Testament, the quality of awareness surely does not, as evidenced pointedly in Jesus' parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, which, even given our modern predilection for worthiness at all costs, must presumably pose something of a stumbling block to the spiritual director's summary dismissal of the Jesus prayer. In the Islamic tradition, growing out of those same Semitic roots, mercy is a foremost among the names of God. And Islamic prayer begins always with the invocation, in the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. One begins to suspect that this term mercy must have some pride of place that gets lost in the modern translations. Helen Luke, in her marvelous book Old Age, offers what may be the key to this riddle, discovered of all places in the American Heritage Dictionary. The word mercy, she explains, derives from the ancient Etruscan word merch. The words commerce and merchant share the same root. And so, at heart, mercy means some kind of exchange or transaction. It is a connection word. Elaborating on this somewhat surprising linguistic kinship, she explains, like so many other meanings hidden in our language, the word commerce, debased to commercialism, has lost much of its dignity. But the root meaning of exchange persisted and developed in another context, its meaning deepening through the French merci, to grateful response and kindness of heart, and finally to the compassion and forgiveness, including all our shades of darkness, whereby we are able to open ourselves to the mercy. This is the ultimate exchange that, when we come to a final letting go, may reveal to us the whole. We are all of the mercy, Luke feels, and it is from her that I picked up my own preference for the term. Insofar as we are able to open our hearts and entrust ourselves to it, the mercy is able to move us steadily toward that final letting go into the whole, which Luke describes elsewhere in her book through a striking image, the weaving of the threads of life into the whole cloth of a shroud. For Luke, the mercy is first and foremost the great weaver, collecting and binding the scattered and broken parts of our lives in a tapestry of divine love. Thomas Merton is thinking in a similar vein in his wonderful essay, The Good Samaritan. He points out that the word translated as mercy in English, misericordia in Latin, is hesed in the original Semitic, which actually means a fierce bonding love, as between committed lovers. It is not about pity, but about passion. Merton writes, hesed is fidelity. It is also strength. It is ultimate and unfailing because it is the power that binds one person to another in a covenant of hearts. So deep is this connection, Merton realizes, that even though the moods of God's anger may seem to come and go like passing clouds from the face of the sun, the mercy itself, the sun, is unchanging, fundamental, and stable because it is the love by which he seeks and chooses his chosen and binds them to himself. So when we think of mercy, we should be thinking first and foremost of a bond, an infallible link of love that holds the created and uncreated realms together. The mercy of God does not come and go, granted to some and refused to others. Why? Because it is unconditional, always there, underlying everything. It is literally the force that holds everything in existence, the gravitational field in which we live and move and have our being. Just like that little fish swimming desperately in search of water, we too, in the words of Psalm 103, swim in mercy as in an endless sea. Mercy is God's innermost being turned outward to sustain the visible and created world in unbreakable love. To think this way perhaps takes some getting used to. From our traditional theological models, we are used to thinking in terms of God up there and ourselves down here. God wholly unknown to us, and of a fundamentally different substance, of which we are but a very distant reflection. But as the language of modern quantum physics penetrates increasingly into the basic metaphors of theology, allowing us to think more freely in terms of conservation of energy, we can begin to see how God and creation actually exist in an energetic continuum. Just as we now know that matter is actually condensed energy, i.e. energy in a more dense and slow-moving form, would it be too great a leap to say that energy as we experience it, as movement, force, light, is a condensation of divine will and purpose? In other words, energy is what happens when divine being expresses itself outwardly. My daughter Lucy, in fact, stumbled quite innocently upon this insight at the tender age of 3 when she came into my bedroom one morning singing a song she had made up. "I'll sing you a song of God in his heaven, where years turn to tables and trees turn to love." Years turn to tables, the subtle but palpable energy of time, measurable in our lives as the coherence of patterns and the weight of years, suddenly transformed itself in her child's imagination into something immediate and solid, a table. And in the same breath of her imagination, something equally immediate and solid, trees, evaporated into the more subtle but still palpable energy of love. Same God, different frequency, different outward manifestation. Einstein would have loved it. So too would St. John the Evangelist. Lucy's insight certainly resonates profoundly with the opening lines of John's Gospel. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made." John 1:1-3. If we understand word to mean at root vibration, the out speaking of the divine will and purpose, then the word is that which makes manifest the fullness of divine purpose as it moves outward into form. This energetic reading of the gospel text might help explain the persistent mystical intuition undergirding so much of the New Testament, that Jesus Christ, as the human incarnation of the divine word, or logos, is the fundamental ordering principle of the cosmos, in whom all things hold together. One who has caught the profound theological implications of these developments in contemporary physics is the popular Episcopal preacher and writer Barbara Brown Taylor. Speaking of the radical shift in her image of God brought about by her exposure to quantum physics, she writes, "Where is God in this picture? God is all over the place. God is up there, down here, inside my skin and out. God is the web, the energy, the space, the light, not captured in them, as if any of those concepts were more real than what unites them, but revealed in that singular, vast net of relationship that animates everything that is." From this remarkable insight, she moves on to an even more remarkable conclusion. "At this point in my thinking, it is not enough for me to proclaim that God is responsible for all this unity. Instead, I want to proclaim that God is the unity, the very energy, the very intelligence, the very elegance and passion that make it all go." Her point may seem like a nuance, but it is a crucially important one. In other words, to express the implication of her insight in my own terms, our visible, created universe is not simply an object created by a wholly other God in order to manifest his love, but that love itself, the very heart of God, fully expressive in the dimension of time and form. Creation is not somewhere else. A river runs through it. That river is God.
The Holy Element. When we speak in these terms, of course, we begin to use the classic language of the mystics, the language of visionary utterance. For 7th century German visionary Jacob Burma, a shoemaker by trade, whose voluminous cosmological treatises had their origin in a quarter of an hour of intense mystical illumination. The name in German for mercy was Barmherzigkeit, warm heartedness. Burma saw mercy as the holy element, the root energy out of which all else in the visible universe is made. The mercy is holy substantiality, the innermost essence of being itself. It is that river of God running like the sap through the tree of life. Lest we be inclined to discount this insight as merely the ramblings of a God-intoxicated medieval mystic, it is astonishing to discover virtually an identical insight revealed by the contemporary and eminently sane psychotherapist Gerald May, co-founder of Shalem Institute for Spiritual Direction in Bethesda, Maryland. In a striking chapter in his book, Will and Spirit, May affirms from a clinical standpoint, once the various differentiations and feeling tones have been stripped away from our subjective emotional life, what remains is a raw root energy that is finally none other than divine love. It is as if agape, divine love, were the base metal. Irreducible and unadulterated, he writes, the universe runs on an energy that is at its core unconditionally loving. May's vision of agape, divine love, is very close to Burma's and my own notion of mercy. Far from pity or condescension, it is the very heartbeat of God resonant in creation. The warmth that pulses through all things as the divine mystery flows out into created form. Mercy and hope. If you've stayed with my argument so far, even in a willing suspension of disbelief sort of way, you'll find yourself suddenly set down in a very different universe from the one you have grown accustomed to inhabiting in these recent post-Enlightenment centuries. Rather than living in a clockwork universe run on implacable scientific principles by an absentee landlord god, or even more desolate, a totally random, nobody-in-charge universe where the only law is the law of the jungle, instead, you wake up inside a warm-hearted and purposive intelligence, a coherence of which you yourself are part of the expression. This is the world of mercy, and it is, in fact, the world of all ancient and perennial religious consciousness, for which quantum physics is merely the latest purveyor of a wisdom supplied in former days by visionary imagination. The Greek patristic fathers, who were well acquainted with this world, called it the intelligible universe, of which our own sensible universe is a cross-section in time and space. More recently, the modern Sufi master Kabir Helminski speaks of this inner engendering and sustaining universe as the electromagnetic field of love. Now, it was this intelligible universe that my own teacher Rafe came to know and move about in towards the end of his life, and what I believe he was insisting on when he named it the body of hope. Our continuing journey together beyond his physical death would not be simply a matter of sporadic mystical visitations, seemingly in defiance of the laws of nature, but would unfold within a coherent field, obeying its own laws of higher causality. This field is like a luminous web, as Barbara Brown Taylor called it, intended to connect and interweave everything, in which all the knot ends of reality come together in a huge tapestry of divine love. To see it is like suddenly being able to see the love itself, the pattern in the random dots of the universe. To say that this body of hope is really an energetic field may be confusing, I realize, to readers accustomed to thinking of a body as a solid corpuscular thing. But practitioners of Asian medicine, along with quantum physicists, have also long shared this belief, considering the outer, or physical, body to be interpenetrated by more subtle energetic bodies, the etheric, astral, and causal, to be specific. The causal body correlates closely with what the Greek patristic fathers called the intelligible. And innumerable mystics, both Eastern and Western, have spoken of the experience generally accessed in states of samsati, deep contemplative prayer, of encountering their own body in exactly the way Barbara Brown Taylor describes, as a luminous web. In the language of both quantum physics and perennial mysticism, body is simply another word for an organized energy field, irrespective of its physical density. But is it really there? This body of hope? For the time being, all I would ask of you is a continued, willing suspension of disbelief. If it could be shown to be true, that our life is connected to an innermost essence of great profundity and power, and that access to it is through what is innermost in our own selves, then we would not only have a conceptual understanding of mystical hope, but a practical way of orienting ourselves towards it. Mystical hope would simply be what happens when we touch this innermost ground and it floods forth into our being as strength and joy. Hope would be the mercy, divine love itself, coursing through our being like lightning, finding a clear path to the ground.
The point veers. If we dwell in the mercy, does it also dwell in us? If mercy is about a connection, then presumably there must be an actual point of contact where our own innermost ground and the mercy meet as simply one. For centuries, Christian mystics have spoken about that point of interface, but in language veiled and hedged. Since it is a primary requirement of Christian theological orthodoxy, that the distinction between creator and creature, between God and ourselves, be stringently preserved. But visionary insight, and certainly this can be verified through personal experience as we converge toward our own center, reveals that as we so converge, the membrane between the worlds gets thinner and thinner. The sense of intertwining is more and more mysterious. Where does God end and I begin? Even the phrasing of the question reveals its essential speciousness. There is in the soul a something in which God dwells, and there is in the soul a something in which the soul dwells in God, writes Meister Eckhart, cautiously picking his way around the words. This mysterious something Eckhart calls the foundation of the soul. It has been described over and over. The inner light of Quaker mystic George Fox, for example. But perhaps nowhere more clearly and eloquently than in Thomas Merton's remarkable essay, A Member of the Human Race. Here, Merton recalls his own initiation into the same kind of unitive seeing my friend Rosalind described earlier. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the middle of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed by the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I was theirs. For a moment, his illusory sense of separateness melted, and he was at one, in the heart of God, with the whole of humanity. Pondering the source of this unity, Merton concludes the essay in a burst of pure visionary splendor. Again, that expression, le point vierge, I cannot translate it, comes in here. At the center of our being is a point of nothingness, which is untouched by sin and illusion, a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God written in us as our poverty, as our indigence, as our sonship. It is like a pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It is in everybody, and if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing. It is only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere. While Merton claims not to be able to translate this phrase, le point vierge, the virgin point, he in fact does so clearly in several of his other writings. The term itself he picked up from the French scholar Louis Massillon, who in turn was translating 9th century Sufi mystic Al-Halaj's treatise on the heart. The point vierge is the last irreducible secret center of the heart where God alone penetrates, where the last veils of our createdness give way into God's all-enfolding mercy. In an earlier passage, in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, Merton had noted, Massillon has some deeply moving pages in the Mardi de Dar es Salaam about the desert, the tears of Hagar, the Muslims, the point vierge of the spirit, the center of our nothingness, where in apparent despair one meets God and is found completely in his mercy. Merton's writing in these passages is both bold and cautious. Bold in that he claims, perhaps more clearly than any other Christian mystical writer to my knowledge, that at the center of our being is an innermost point of truth which shares not only the likeness, but even the substance of God's own being. And yet cautious in that, following the bent of Christian tradition, Merton makes it clear that access to this center is not at our command. We cannot get to it. It can only get to us by flowing from the innermost outward into our being. Furthermore, he is even more insistent than his Sufi sources that this flow is entered only through our complete poverty, our complete nothingness. Joining a long stream of mystics, he insists that what is true being appears in this realm as non-being, as nothingness, and can be approached only through a way of being that, in our ordinary consciousness, seems totally counterinstinctive. A way of being that embraces poverty, unknowing, surrender, death. We cannot find this innermost, but only be found by it, in our wholehearted willingness to join it at the point of nothing. This is the koan that dissolves the illusory dichotomy between grace and works, and that allows that access point, which we know in our hearts is truly there, to draw us into the luminous web. It is through this little point or spark of pure truth that the mercy flows into us and through us. It is the spring at the bottom of the well of our being, through which hope is continually renewed. Merton's experience of the point vierge did not grow out of reading about Sufism. It grew from his own deep experience of contemplative prayer, where one swims down into the depths and finds, at the wellspring of one's being, the hidden ground of love, as Merton calls it. As a teacher of contemplative prayer myself, I find over and over that those who are drawn to this path are drawn to the innermost, which they realize is not personal divinized selfhood, but the divine ground itself, manifesting in and through their individual form. In workshop after workshop, I meet people, many of them no longer practicing Christians, who, despite all theological indoctrination about the complete otherness of God, have stood their ground, firm in their innate knowledge that at the foundation of the soul, at that point vierge, something of our being presses deep into the heart of God and begins to swim in the infinite ocean of God's mercy. That ocean is our source and substance, the ground of our own arising, the foundation of hope. Those who experience it may leave the church, but they do not leave this ground. Once experienced, it is undeniable.
We swim in mercy as in an endless sea. We swim in mercy as in
mystical hope, sea. Trusting in the mercy of God, by Cynthia Bourgeau.
This chapter has been read by
Janine Seiler Jones,
Nan DeLatch,
and
Elizabeth Combs.
Mercy Chants, arranged and sung by
Susan J. Latimer.